welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Happy New Year. As we enter 2018, it's time to take stock of our health and once again remind ourselves that there are many non-medical factors that impact it. Take housing as an example. For most of the listening audience, we're blessed not to have to think much about it beyond where we want to live. But among people that are frequently hospitalized, a quarter of them are what is known as housing insecure, meaning anything from being unable to afford the rent, living in transitional housing, or outright homeless. Not having a stable roof over your head can dramatically impact health, especially for the numerous chronic conditions that constitute the bulk of what we spend our healthcare dollars on. Now comes word that more hospitals are investing in housing stock in their local communities, both as a way to improve downtrodden areas in their own neighborhoods, but also to create affordable and mixed-income housing for both employees and patients, especially those at highest risk of homelessness. It's all part of a broader strategy by these hospitals to impact people at the core of their lives, rather than simply bandaging wounds and moving them along. It's now trying to address the underlying issue. My guest today is Megan Sandell. She is a medical doctor and an associate professor of pediatrics at the Boston University School of Medicine. She's also co-principal investigator with Children's Health Watch and a nationally recognized expert on housing and child health. She also is formerly the director of pediatric healthcare for the Homeless Clinic at Boston Medical Center. Lastly, she serves as medical director of the National Center for Medical Legal Partnership at George Washington University. Dr. Megan Sandell is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Megan Sandell, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start by asking you about this news out of Boston Medical Center that the medical center is going to be investing in local housing for patients. How did that even come about? I mean, why does a hospital, more or less a hospital, invest in housing?
Yeah, thanks for having me, John. It's interesting. So we as a hospital, Boston Medical Center, is kind of the largest safety net hospital in New England. And what we've realized more and more is that so much of our patients' health has to do with where they live and the neighborhoods they're coming from and the types of housing. And especially as we look at our most expensive patients, we find that so many of them are homeless or housing unstable. We actually did a survey and found that 25% of our patients at any given moment in the hospital staying overnight are homeless. So we really felt like we needed to lean in to try and find some solutions. We had an obligation to, as part of one of our capital projects to redo our campus, in order to get that approval from the Department of Public Health, we had to invest in a community health initiative. And so we ended up convincing the Department of Public Health to let us put all of the money for that community health initiative towards affordable housing. And we really view it as not that we're going to become landlords or we're going to create new housing as much as we're going to partner with housing agencies. And those housing partners are going to be able to create housing and are going to be able to have more capacity to be able to work with us to improve the health of our patients.
It's so interesting because it really does make sense. And I just want to clarify, when you say expensive patients, you're talking about patients that are frequently hospitalized, that are costing the system, as it were, a lot of money, that are having chronic health conditions exacerbated by homelessness or housing insecurity. And so what we sometimes call in the trade frequent utilizers or frequent flyers. And so how will it play out? I mean, how does this, is there any precedent for this?
Yes, there is precedence for hospitals and health systems to start to invest in housing. What I've seen traditionally is that some of them are doing it more with a community health improvement in mind. So Nationwide Children's Hospital is adopting its neighborhood right next to the hospital, the Southern Orchard neighborhood, which has been like systematically disinvested in for, you know, generations. It put $8 to $10 million into buying abandoned homes, renovating them, selling them to actually people who work at the hospital, being an investor in a new housing development, doing jobs programs in the communities, like really leaning into their mission as an anchor institution, really trying to improve the neighborhood. Or say Dignity Health System is another example. They are an amazing health system that has put 5% of their entire endowment into investing in creating more affordable housing. They've estimated they've created over 14,000 new apartments in the California area. Or Bon Secours Hospital in Baltimore, which like is in the southwest part of Baltimore, has started to create a community development organization building housing. They actually own and operate close to 1,000 units. So I think there's been that kind of push. There's also been examples from hospitals and health systems doing this type of population health initiative they've been creating relationships with housers where their highest cost patients then get access to housing, and they do it as a way to reduce cost. What we're trying to do at Boston Medical Center is trying to think about it both ways. We're trying to do community health investing. We're trying to partner with community development corporations in our community to try and support them. We literally picked up the phone and said to them, here, we have this pot of money. What's your pain point? Like, what's the thing that you wish you had money to do? And then shape them in ways so that we could maximize health impact, but also potentially ways in which we could create relationships with them so that when we have a high-cost patient, can we create a partnership with them so that we're able to house that patient faster? So it's a community health investment first, but we're trying to evaluate it also with a population health outcome in mind.
So the precedents that you mentioned, a nationwide being, it's Columbus, right? Columbus, Ohio.
Yep.
And so did that help in a sense in making the pitch to the Boston area to be able to say, hey, we can spend these public health dollars in this way because there are these other precedents? I mean, I think what seems different to me is, I guess it also makes sense, certainly economic sense, for hospitals to invest right around their physical campuses, especially if those areas are considered slums or, you know, in poor conditions. Certainly it stands to reason that having affordable or subsidized, to some extent, housing for employees, you know, makes, in a sense, will help, you know, it's a loaded word, but gentrify those areas. But I think, to me, what Boston Medical Center is doing is sort of an increased emphasis on your actual patient population. Like, that's what seems like you're kind of pushing the envelope to me. I mean, it's very admirable.
Yeah, I think what we're trying to think about is, can we build a business case for these community health investments for the future, right? Like, to an extent, we have this obligation. We're trying to apply this money more creatively. And we're really trying to say, okay, can there be a quote-unquote return on investment for these dollars where we're going to see improved health of the community? Some of the dollars are actually we're putting into investments. So $500,000 we're putting into an equity fund whose goal is to not only get a return in terms of a financial return, but they're also picking projects with a health report card in mind. And that equity fund is called the Healthy Neighborhood Equity Fund. It's a really cool model. And so we were the hospital that invested in that, right? Banks invested, high net worth individuals, foundations, city government. But then we are a hospital that invested in this equity fund. And we're committed that if we get that money back, we'll put that money back out into other investments in the future. One other cool investment we're doing is we're giving a no-cost loan to attract a healthier retailer to a neighborhood that doesn't have a really affordable grocery store right now. And so we have worked with a really amazing grocery store in Washington, D.C., where they're going to come up. We're going to help them hire a community outreach manager. They're going to hire locally. They're going to locally source the food. They're going to hire really prioritize people like reentering citizens and others, and being able to really create kind of an anchor healthy retailer in the community with like a cafe where people can like sit and eat food together. And those are things that I think are really important to us that, yeah, we may make our money back with those types of investments, but we also hopefully are going to be able to see other returns than just money in terms of health outcomes.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Megan Sandell, who is the Associate Director of the GROW Clinic at Boston Medical Center. She's also the Principal Investigator of Children's Health Watch. And we're talking about Boston Medical Center's recently announced investments in affordable housing. And you were, Megan, you were just telling me about a zero interest or no cost loan for a grocery store in a vulnerable area, or I would assume probably based on things I've read or even what we have in Tulsa, like a food desert area where there's not, you know, available healthy grocery, for example?
Yeah, so what sometimes happens, so food desert is kind of a designation where you have to travel, say, in a city area more than a mile to get food. What we find from a lot of our patients is they don't live in food deserts, but they live in kind of food swamps, right, where the only available food to buy is that, like, corner store where the healthier food is really expensive, the unhealthy food is much cheaper. And so what I think is exciting is bringing, in different community meetings when I go to different neighborhoods, they always talk about wanting a Trader Joe's. They want a place that has, like, good cost food but is healthier, and particularly want places where you can order food and not just take it out but actually sit and have a meal. And so what's nice about this food market is that it will have not only the ability to buy healthier foods at a lower price point, but then also potentially pre-prepared foods that you can sit down and have a meal with their families.
So when you went to medical school and thought about becoming a doctor, did you ever think you would be talking about housing and nutrition in kind of the way that your career has taken shape?
I think I always knew that I cared a lot about, I'm not sure I would have called it social determinants of health at that point, but I always kind of felt like I was attracted to helping the underserved and thinking about ways in which to help people be healthier in kind of non-traditional ways. I did a ton of health education when I was in medical school, like where we started a program where we partnered medical students with teachers in New Hampshire and Vermont to basically teach health education classes. And so I was like really excited about different ways in which we could help make people healthier. For me, I was very lucky to find housing early. In my medical residency, my pediatric residency, we were really trained to think about advocacy and what were the ways in which we could advocate for our patients. And we ended up zeroing in on doing a project on housing as interns. And it kind of morphed for us. We were originally thinking like we were going to do a website, and it was like so pie in the sky. And we thought we'd create all these, you know, resource lists for our patients. And our mentors were like, whoa, 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 like just do a report, like just look at ways in which housing and health are impacted. And so we decided to do that, and then we put a twist on it. We ended up sending emails to all of our friends that were in different residency programs across the country and said, send us stories. Tell us like patient experiences around how housing had impacted their health. And so we put the report together, and we called it the Doc for Kids report, and we ended up doing a press conference. And the coup was we got Senator John Kerry to agree to come to our press conference, and his staff helped us organize it. And we went to a house in Roxbury, which is a neighborhood right next to Boston Medical Center, that had gotten the last of the Get Out the Lead dollars. And they needed, you know, more appropriation in order to have more money to de-lead houses. And we ended up getting a fair amount of press coverage. And it was this interesting moment where it was like, oh, I can use my stethoscope in a different way. Like, I get to show up and say, doctors care about housing. Here's all the ways in which doctors care about housing, and have people think about it differently and care about it and start to think that they need to fund it differently. And it was incredibly life-changing for me. It made me realize, like, research could be a way to make change. You didn't just have to do good service. You could think about research as a tool. Made me think a lot about communication and how do you communicate research findings, and then how do you ultimately use your stethoscope, your white coat, in order to really make change to help people.
That's a pretty impactful outcome for a group of interns. I mean, wow. To have Senator Kerry there?
So the joke was every day after rounds, I would call his office and I'd be like, hi, this is Megan Sandel calling again. I want to invite Senator Kerry to a press conference that we're planning. And I think they finally just got so sick of me that they were like, fine, we'll give you this staffer, plan it, you know, great. And so it was definitely I think there are lessons for particularly students around talent versus tenacity. And so I will always take tenacity over talent. I would not take no until we got him to agree to come to our press conference. Let's be honest, interns talking about housing is not that interesting. But if Senator Kerry was going to show up, we were going to make sure that there were cameras and the globe was there and all these other things.
I want to ask you, stretch from housing, because you've done a lot of research in your career and written many medical journal articles, as well as being quoted often in the lay press. But one of your relatively recent articles, actually from 2016, is something, I'll just read the title, Neighborhood Level Interventions to Improve Childhood Opportunity and Lift Children Out of Poverty. What do you mean by that? What's the neighborhood level intervention that's going to improve opportunities for kids and lift them out of poverty?
More and more, there are some really great tools out there where you could understand why neighborhoods actually predict to health. So there's kind of this famous phrase from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that your zip code may be more important to your health than your genetic code. And what it tries to talk about is that for many years, we've acknowledged that if you're from a certain neighborhood, you're from a certain zip code, you may have very different health outcomes, and we can kind of map those. And there are ways now in which people think of it, literally talk about it as opportunity. What are the ways in which neighborhoods differ? And so there in the article, we feature some tools that you can actually now look at online and see maps of different neighborhoods that have different levels of opportunity. What it is the Kirwan Institute at Ohio State took 19 different factors and basically analyzed them for how they predicted towards health and economic development. And then you basically will rate a neighborhood on 5 levels: very high opportunity, medium opportunity, low opportunity, and very low opportunity. And then the very low opportunity, they actually will create these heat maps where it's like a very light yellow up through darker yellow to orange to light red to dark red. And dark red is the best. That's the highest opportunity neighborhoods. And the very, very faint yellow is the lowest opportunity neighborhoods. And then Brandeis University actually partnered with the Kirwan Institute to put all those maps online. And it's on a website called diversitydatakids.org. And so you can now pull up an opportunity map for any city, all 100 cities in the United States metro areas. You can pull up an opportunity map and see where, honestly, do kids of color live? Where do kids in poverty live? And what does their opportunity map look like? And it gives you a sense of the ways in which, when we talk about helping kids be lifted out of poverty, that's not just an individual level intervention. That's as much about the neighborhood that they live in and ways in which we deconcentrate poverty. Though the work hadn't really come out before we wrote the article, there's been a lot of research around this by Raj Chetty. And what Raj Chetty talks about is, if you're a young kid and you live in a concentrated poverty neighborhood up through like age 13, on average, your lifetime earnings can be a third less than a kid that moves from a concentrated poverty neighborhood to a neighborhood that's less concentrated poverty, that has more opportunity. And so it makes us start to think about ways in which, if we're really going to help kids be healthier, we have to tackle poverty. The reality is 44% of kids in this country live below 200% of the federal poverty level. It's an enormous number. And so we have to start to tackle ways in which we can lift kids out of poverty, address the opportunity gap. In that article, we feature one intervention called the Vital Village Network, which is started at Boston Medical Center by one of my colleagues, Dr. Renee Boynton-Jarrett. And it's just the idea of like putting together community groups to network together to build more collective efficacy, to actually try to both, I think, help kids on an individual family level in terms of coping and other things, but also ways in which you can economically empower them so that they can be lifted out of poverty.
You're the principal investigator of something called Children's Health Watch. Tell us a little bit about that research network and what you do in that role.
So Children's Health Watch is it's a research policy network that was started in the late 1990s, actually in response to welfare reform. A group of pediatricians led by Dr. Deborah A. Frank really felt like they were seeing a lot of kids already that had failure to thrive. And they were pediatricians that were either developmental pediatricians or specialists in nutrition. And they said, wow, like, we already are seeing kids that are suffering because of poverty and other types of policies. And now here's this new policy that's coming down that we fear is going to impact, literally play out on the bodies of our patients. And so they banded together and they said, we're going to start to collect data on families with young children in our various different healthcare settings and literally watch whether or not those trends change over time in terms of how those hardships, things like hunger and unstable housing and problems keeping the heater lights on, correlate with health outcomes. Like, are you developmentally on track? Have you had a hospitalization in your young life? Is your parent rating you to be in good health or in only fair or poor health? And what we've ended up doing is really publishing a lot of the seminal research around how do those hardships play out in terms of adverse childhood health, and then how do policies actually support kids? So we've published research on how SNAP, commonly known as food stamps, actually protects kids and actually makes them healthier, or WIC, and showing that WIC is an excellent program and really helps not only have better birth outcomes, but also has better kid outcomes. And then we published research on housing subsidies and showing that, yeah, housing subsidies can act like a vaccine. It can kind of keep kids healthier now and in the future. It protects you against multiple threats. Like, if you're a food insecure family and you have a housing subsidy, your kid is twofold less likely to be underweight than a similar family who's food insecure and eligible for that subsidy but not getting it. And so we've been trying more and more to really change the conversation using our data first but then also trying to think about new ways in which to try and get policymakers to really view kids and families as important places to invest and to be able to change their kids' future.
You've also, as a pediatrician, you know, still practicing, as, you know, mm-hmm. you have these, wear these many hats and talked about how you're, you as an advocate, a physician advocate, use your white coat and stethoscope differently, or, I mean, in multiple ways. Tell us a little bit about a common childhood illness, asthma, that we see a lot. Like, what are, how do these factors play together in terms of housing or housing insecurity and a neighborhood effects in terms of the prevalence of asthma or the severity?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think people don't realize, but it's been estimated that about 40% of asthma is related to home environment. Things like either issues with mold or sometimes different types of pets or pests in the environment. Sometimes even common things like household chemicals, either cleaning agents or scented candles or other things. And so I think home environment becomes really important and something that we always need to consider. Some patients, particularly low-income patients, sometimes have really hard choices to make. They can't afford rent in certain places, and sometimes they're having to choose, say, a substandard apartment, even though that may not be legal, right? They have the right to live in a place that is free of those types of toxins. Sometimes they still have those issues. There's been some really interesting research done out of Cincinnati Children's Hospital by Dr. Andy Beck and Dr. Rob Kahn and Dr. Melissa Klein around this idea of thinking about housing conditions and how that trends to asthma cases, and then also looking at how neighborhood conditions can trend to asthma cases. So one example was they had started getting families showing up to their children's hospital with a letter from their landlord threatening to evict families if they used their air conditioner in the summertime. And they got one of those letters and they were like, oh, this is kind of strange. And then they got a second one of those letters. And Cincinnati Children's actually has an on-site medical legal partnership. So they have lawyers that literally have an office down the hall from where the pediatricians are. And they started bringing the letters to the lawyers and saying, what do you think? Like, is this legal? Can they be evicted? And so the lawyers actually went back to the case studies and started looking at all the asthma cases that they had gotten recently and actually mapped them and started to see that a single landlord who owned all of these different buildings was like systematically disinvesting in these buildings. And so they actually went to court and sued because this landlord was getting federal money for rental subsidies and other things, but not keeping up their end of the bargain. And they actually forced the sale of that development to a much better housing landlord that was willing to invest in it. So that was actually published in Pediatrics, I think in 2014, where they showed that a substandard case series was founded through kind of medical legal partnership surveillance. What was interesting is that a couple of years later, they started mapping in communities the housing code violations and looking at a heat map, like what were the neighborhoods that had the highest level of housing code violations in certain types of blocks. And then they looked at kids who had came to their emergency department and looked at what was the likelihood of a kid who came to their emergency department coming back again with an asthma attack. And they showed that if they lived in a neighborhood with a higher density of housing code violations, that kid was more likely to come back to the emergency department. And so think about it. The first case study I talked about was individual cases linking together to find a population health trend. The second publication, which was published in Health Affairs in 2016, they looked at a community-level data set that predicted to individual-level risk factors. And so I think it kind of speaks to particularly asthma and home quality and neighborhood quality, that the interplay is not just on the individual level, it's on the community level. And we can't just interact and think about solutions on a one-dimensional. We have to think about it on a multi-level.
Well, it's just so striking to think that so much of asthma, you attribute 44% or something to sort of these housing effects or the home environment, I guess you said. And then also the fact that, you know, kid may come to the hospital or the doctor's office and we might treat the asthma exacerbation acutely, and then they're just going right back to that same home environment and not really treating the underlying problem. So it really speaks to that neighborhood effect of, and the legal partnership, as you mentioned, trying to address the underlying factor. You've spent some time, I think, involved with the medical legal partnership. Can you just comment about that a little bit?
Yeah, so medical-legal partnerships started at Boston Medical Center in the early 1990s by the then chairman, Dr. Barry Zuckerman. And the story that he'll tell is he was, you know, really frustrated. We had all these kids with asthma that were bouncing back and forth between the emergency department and the inpatient unit. And the parents started complaining to them that, like, they knew that their kid was allergic to mold. And here we were saying they needed to get rid of mold, but they kept asking the landlord. And so, you know, we're doctors. We don't always understand the stuff. We were writing all these letters to the landlord and trying to get them to make changes, and nothing was happening. And we were, like, really frustrated. And so what Dr. Zuckerman talks about is that he was at a cocktail party explaining this to a friend of his, and one of his friends said, well, what does the law say? And he ended up looking, and sure enough, the law was actually pretty good. The law said that mold was actually illegal, but he didn't have anyone to enforce the law. And so it was then that he decided, well, I'm chairman of pediatrics. I can hire an attorney and bring an attorney on site and have the attorney write the special language. And what happened is when the attorney sent the letter, the landlord did it right away. And so it became this idea that many of our social determinants, many of our social needs are actually legal in nature. And you actually need legal expertise to actually make a difference in them. And so medical-legal partnership has become this model where you integrate legal specialists, often from the legal aid community, to be part of the healthcare team. And the key to it is that it's not that everybody needs to see the lawyer. It's not that everybody needs to go to court. It's that oftentimes when you're in a healthcare setting, and if you screen patients and you understand what their legal issues are, you sometimes get intervened with very simple types of intervention. Sometimes it's as simple as writing a letter. Sometimes it's as simple as being able to do better case management. Sometimes you do need to see an attorney. Sometimes you do need to go to court. But oftentimes you can address these issues with just a little bit of legal advice. And by integrating into the healthcare setting, you're able to detect these problems earlier and solve them faster.
Just so interesting, like a cocktail party aha moment that essentially has changed the nature of how many of us practice. I mean, just really, really groundbreaking type of strategy, and just so smart to collaborate in that way.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that I was exposed to it so early in my career, right? Like when I was a resident, I was able, when I, you know, had that eureka moment with the kid in the ICU with asthma, where I was asking them what had changed. And it became clear that the family had mice. They had found some mouse dropping in this kid's bed. And unfortunately, they had asked the landlord to make a change. They didn't. So the family got a cat. And they got a cat because they needed to get rid of the mice. And the kid was allergic to cats. And that put this kid in the ICU. And so for me, it was that eureka moment where I was like, I can't send this kid home. The prescription I want to write is a healthy home, and that's not stocked at the pharmacy at Boston Medical Center. But the good news is I was able then to pick up the phone and call the lawyer that was part of our medical treatment team, and they educated me on how to get the landlord now to make the change and to be able to use code enforcement as a tool. And that's how you stock that pharmacy with a healthy home, is you have the right specialist.
Well, therein is the arc of your career, Dr. Megan Sandell, because being able to prescribe that healthy home is now much more possible because of the place that you work. It sounds like a very enlightened city hospital, Boston Medical Center, which is investing heavily in community and affordable housing. I want to thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is Dr. Megan Sandell, who is Associate Director of the GROW Clinic at Boston Medical Center. She's also Principal Investigator of Children's Health Watch. Dr. Sandell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.